The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for 1997's Speed 2 Cruise Control. If you do not wish to have this movie spoiled, please watch this movie before listening to the following podcast. Was it a speedy action movie or was it just dead in the water? We watched Speed 2 to find out if it was redeemable. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Boy? Oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. Watch this movie, do you think we should? It's got bad dialogue, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy?
Welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features Cast, this time focusing on Speed 2 Cruise Control from 1997. My name is Trevor Holland, and I am joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher. Thank you, Trevor, for having me back again for the Redeeming Features Cast.
You don't need to keep thanking me for this. I mean, who else is going to be insane enough to do this podcast with me? I mean, really.
Good point. I don't think we'd find many people in the general public that would want to actually sit down and subject themselves. I use the word subjective very loosely, subject themselves to these sort of films. But hey, I'm always up for the challenge, so I appreciate that.
Fair enough. Excellent. And for those that listened last time, Speed 2, this was your suggestion. And I'll get into, I suppose, a bit of information a bit later on. I don't know. I kind of got the feeling that you may slightly regret the decision you made.
Oh, definitely. I think I was sort of going in with the whole, you know, the whole view. I haven't seen it for a few years. I think it's always that sort of interest in wanting to sort of re-see the movie again, sort of on your own terms as well. And I think, oh gosh, as soon as I probably got to about 5 or 10 minutes into it, I'm like, I'm regretting this decision. But hey, we must persist. And as we know with the rule with the Rufus Project, we have to watch right until the finale of the end credits. So I knew I was in for 2 hours and 5 minutes. Ouch, of a bit of pain. So I do apologise for having to subject you to this, Trevor, but it was very much interest's sake that sort of led me back to Speed 2, because as I said, I hadn't seen it for a few years and was interested to kill two birds with one stone. But yeah, I'm kind of regretting that decision now.
Well, of course, before we do get too much into this, we need to go through, I suppose, a bit of the specifics of the film. So I've got a synopsis here that I pulled offline of Speed 2. So if you don't know, Speed 2 is about a computer hacker that breaks into the computer system of the Seabourn Legend cruise liner and sets it speeding on a collision course towards a giant oil tanker. Super tense.
Exactly. I don't even think those would be drawn even when you watch the movie, so we've got to give it some sort of intensity. So
We do. And of course, we do need to talk about the turkey trivia, where we talk turkey about the turkey and get a few interesting facts. So I've done a bit of digging. So the IMDb rating on this is a grand total of 3.7 out of 10. It was made on a budget of about $160 million, and according to the IMDb sources, its taking was about $164.5 million. So I believe that probably would not be considered a success.
Yeah, definitely not, I think. So what did you say, sorry, the budget was about 160?
The budget was about $160 million.
Okay,
it
and then...
Yeah, 164.5 million
okay.
is what it got
Yeah,
back.
They tend to say that the box office needs to be double what they put into it to make its money back. So yeah, I think that could be considered a dud. But now, following in the shoes, following the footsteps, I suppose you could say, or the laneways of Speed Number One, which I believe came out in 1994, I think it was 1995. So we've only been sort of about 2 or 3 years following the first movie. So you can easily see why they wanted to capture, capitalize on a sequel, because I believe the first movie made like $300 million on a budget of like probably less than the second movie. So yeah, I can easily see why the producers were keen on revisiting the Speed series.
Yeah, the big death, the original definitely was, you know, one of those sleeper hits that kind of just came from nowhere and took everyone by surprise with Keanu Reeves stepping up as an action movie star and putting Bill and Ted behind him, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it was actually probably the first movie that really introduced us to Sandra Bullock, I believe. She probably would have been in movies up to this point, but I remember even being as a kid, that was sort of the first thing you saw Sandra Bullock in. She was famous for being in Speed. So, you know, it had some big shoes to follow, to fit, pretty much, or in terms of the first movie. So,
I mean, with a bit of trivia about that too, I mean, Sandra Bullock does come back for Speed 2. However, Keanu Reeves apparently turned down the movie so that he could go on tour with his band Dogstar.
Oh my god, look, I don't know much about Dogstar, but I honestly think that was probably the best choice Keanu ever made, to be honest. Not really saying he's had the biggest career since, but hey, he might not have ended up doing something like The Matrix or some other sort of films of the late 90s, so maybe it was a good thing. So thank you, Dogstar.
And in an interview in 2000, Sandra Bullock apparently jokingly referred to the movie as the biggest piece of crap ever made. Keanu's replacement, Jason Patrick, who plays the lead Alex, I think his name is, or is that her
name?
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah.
Alex, yeah.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, that's right.
He only agreed to make the film on the condition that there were some major script changes to be made, but when he actually arrived on set, he found that the script hadn't changed at all, and he was contractually obligated to make the film, and pretty much found the entire experience miserable and depressing.
Because I think I had read that he'd come from, he was famous from being in something in the early 90s, I can't remember offhand, so he wasn't a big actor at the time, and I don't really think this film was what he could have used to sort of springboard him to a better career, I suppose. But I think it was just more a matter of, we just need a Keanu replacement, and fast. That's all it seemed to reek of the entire time.
Looking back on his catalogue pre-Speed 2, the only thing I actually recognise is The Lost Boys.
He was actually, the more I think about it, I think he's the older brother.
That's right, he was Michael and The Lost Boys.
Oh, wow. God, he should have stopped there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put Lost Boys in the same league as Speed 2. So it's interesting. He would have had a very interesting resume. So that's that's interesting. I didn't actually make the connection, but now I see it.
Yeah, definitely. Lost Boys, definitely a good movie. No doubt about that. we'll find out more about Speed 2 as we progress.
Now, I believe Speed 2 was by the director of Twister as well. So that is, I think Twister came out about 94, 95, actually maybe 96. So this would have probably been the film that sort of was the subsequent one after Twister, kind of that whole sort of thing. Oh, wow, people are interested in these sort of big sets, big things happening, you know, where we'll sequelise Speed. But unfortunately, going the angle of being set on a cruise boat, we're kind of left with sort of mixed results from that. So I think they were really just trying to get onto that wave of, mid-90s sort of disaster movies. Even though really calling Speed 2 disaster movies probably doesn't really work. But it was, yeah, they were trying to do these big budget action movies, which, you know, from the mid-90s, so...
Yeah, actually, another thing I read about it was that the original script, before it was adapted for Speed 2, was actually being looked at to be the third film in the Die Hard series.
So
it looks like instead of sending John McClane to save New York, it looks like they were considering sending John McClane to save a cruise ship.
Oh, God, I actually think it would have worked out with a better result, to be honest. I think it may be coming up in your notes there too, but I think I may have read that the producer, that there have been many ideas for Speed 2 that have been sort of mentioned around, and a lot of scripts that have been sort of thrown at the wall, but he kept having these recurring dreams about a cruise ship hitting into an ocean liner, or, you know, or hitting into mainland or something like that, and he kept pushing for that as being the plot of the film, which it ends up being. And it was pretty much the producer being adamant about his dream being, you know, the set way that the plot should be. And I really think he should have stuck with possibly some of those earlier ideas for the outline of the film.
Indeed. Well, before we, I suppose, get into the nitty-gritty and talk about the movie itself, what we'd like to do on the Redeeming Features cast, because we are trying to redeem these movies when we watch them. We watch them to see if it's possible for these terrible movies, considered terrible movies, to actually have some sort of redeeming factor. So we like to set a baseline. And that baseline, I've headed to Amazon and I've dug through the less than positive reviews and I've come up with this. The title of this review is This the Best They Could Do? What a Piece of Junk. A ship instead of a bus. So they have to search for something to crash into. A computer genius who takes over the ship and nobody simply pulls the plug on the computers and resumes manual steering. It's a ship, for crying out loud, not a supercritical aeroplane. The original speed kept up the pace. With this movie, I kept it up by pushing fast forward for minutes on end. And then the cast. Defoe tries to be really bad, but in the end he was the only guy I grew to like. Bullock gave a repeat performance of the original without the zest of the original. And Patrick, instead of Reeves, is like being out of the frying pan and into the fire. The equivalent of $2 that I paid to rent this tape was the biggest waste of money ever. 1 star.
Ooh, it always helps when you can relate to so much of a review. But, oh my God, knowing we couldn't fast forward this, that killed me so much in this viewing. So I can relate a lot to that viewer.
Absolutely. And if we do get started on, I suppose, what we have experienced and working our way through the movie, again, before I even pressed play, I saw the magical timestamp of 2 hours, and I actually groaned before I even started watching it.
I think I did too, and I'm the one who suggested it. My gosh! So, yeah, and I was thinking, how can they really sustain something of this length? And that was something that I did come back through a lot throughout the viewing of the film to be, oh gosh, surely it's near the end now. Oh, God, there's still 40 minutes to go. So when that sort of stuff starts happening with a movie, you start to go, okay, perhaps it's not holding my attention as much as it should be. So, yeah, that stood out quite a lot to me as well.
Yep, and it starts over the water, and I was trying to work out with the way they do the titles and the way they've got the words kind of coming in and coming out. I was trying to work out if that was just some sort of really bad attempt to try to do a rippling water effect with the words coming across the screen, or if they just thought it looked cool.
Well, yeah, I noticed that a lot. Like, as you even see when the 20th Century Fox logo starts, it kind of, the Fox logo then dissolves into the water, and you kind of, like, admittedly, probably knowing that I'm going to be watching a bad movie, admittedly I went, oh my God, these opening credits are kind of, you know, they're kind of being quirky and kind of cool, and they're kind of fitting that sort of, it's going to be action jam-packed. Unfortunately, obviously, it all goes downhill after that. But yeah, I did notice that whole sort of the watery look of every sort of title. But then the big thing I noticed pretty much from the step after that is they spend the entire opening credits using this very watery theme, because obviously that's where the movie's set. But then pretty much for the first 10 minutes of the film, sorry, not 10 minutes, probably even sort of 7 or so, of the film, it's completely set on roads as much as possible, almost like they're just trying to get those speed fans in of the original movie, get them all hooked in, and then go, okay, cool, we're going to chuck the whole on road thing out of the water and literally take you on the water. So I thought that was really funny how they had the contrast of the watery opening and then straight into all these roads and stuff. I don't know. I don't know if they were just trying to set us up for some sort of false. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that they were trying to appeal to fans of the original movie, having Jason Patrick on his bike chasing down bad guys across narrow roads and through construction things, and then the flip side of that, having Sandra Bullock having a driving test, and of course, you know, she's the one who had to drive the bus in Number 1, and the big joke is that she's a terrible driver.
Well, that's the thing that I shuddered about. How he goes, oh, you know, I don't know what the quote was, but, you know, you'll have your driving test before you know it, you know, and you just think to yourself, oh, gosh, didn't we have an entire movie where she was the driver, the designated driver of, you know, the entire movie. So yeah, I found that quite a weird thing. And look, having not seen the first movie for years, I don't think it's acknowledged that she needs to get driving lessons. It just seemed like a real, her going backwards as a character and not going forwards. And I don't know, I think that just sort of reinforced the fact that the character didn't really have that much depth to her anyway. Like she, and speed, she, you know, I don't know. It was a really weird thing to happen. And I think they just did whatever they could to show as many shots as they can of Rose, just to try and get those, pretty much to lull you into that self sense, you know, that sense of security, you know, and then just pretty much go, sorry guys, we're going to now turn it into Titanic. So it was a weird thing. But that was another thing that sort of, you know, stood out a lot to me. I don't know if you noticed, Trevor, but okay, I'm not saying that everything set on a boat has to feel like Titanic, but the amount of sort of comparisons to the movie Titanic that I was getting was quite, I don't know, quite a lot, to the point of I even had to Google and go, what year did Titanic come out? And it came out the same year as Speed 2, and incidentally the same company released Speed 2. So I thought it was quite, I don't know, I thought the parallels were quite interesting, and I do wonder also too if the producers of Speed 2 were also utilising the sets that were the James Cameron had built for Titanic. I don't know, that just seemed to struck to me the entire time that this felt like a cash-in movie utilising sets that already existed. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I can see your point there, but when you get to like the ballroom scenes, the dining scenes in Speed 2, like their surroundings are nowhere near as opulent.
I understand that too. A lot of my connections were a lot of those sort of underwater scenes, you know, the scenes where he's going under, like, obviously I know a lot of movies use tanks and water tanks and things like that, but it just, a lot of it felt very close to home, and you did feel that they were like, you know, whilst Titanic wasn't filming on the off hours, they'd get the Speed 2 crew in to come and film their scenes. So I don't know, but it might have just been one of those serendipitous things that happened around that time, but I did see a lot of that. A lot of those similarities.
I guess, yeah, when you've got like the lower areas of a cruise ship being narrow corridors and those particular sort of doors that you tend to see in any movie involving ships, I guess. Yeah. So there's not a lot of variety, so if you've got a set which is similar, you can probably easily repurpose it.
I can understand. But yeah, but in a movie that both, you know, Willem Dafoe, Sandra Bullock and UB40 go, how could you really go wrong?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. The Titanic had their string quartet. The, I've forgotten the name of the boat already.
Seaboard something. Yeah, one of those.
I should have it here somewhere. Well, the ship. Yeah. In the Titanic had UB40 as the onboard band.
Yeah, and it's funny because you heard over the course of the soundtrack or over the course of the movie, you heard them sort of deliver a lot of their sort of iconic songs. But there was this big song. If I heard the melody, you know, I'd know it. But there's this main song, this reggae song that they play a lot throughout the movie, and it's also over the closing credits. And I'm like, it's one of those movies I can't think of it now, but when I hear it again, I can't get it out of my head.
I think that, well, obviously the closing credits we should get to in time.
I'm looking a bit far ahead there.
you certainly are. But one thing I like to think about this, especially after seeing UB40, is the fact that there was a time when UB40, I mean, they weren't the biggest band back in the 90s. They had moderate success, but there was a time where they thought that appearing as the onboard band in this movie would have been a good career move.
And hey, it would have been a lot of the people making the movie would have been thinking, ooh, this is probably a good thing for us to have these guys associated with our movie. So, but yeah, but then, you know, my vague knowledge of UB40, I don't even think by 1997 they would have been quite the, I don't know, cruise ship band, or maybe, hey, that's where they were destined for.
Who knows? Moderate success of UB40. I don't think this movie helped their career.
Yeah, not too much. But one thing I really noticed was interesting. I don't know if the world record has been beaten since, but apparently, like, obviously, I'm not purposely skipping to the end of the film, but this does actually feature one of the most expensive scenes ever filmed in a movie in terms of destruction. So I know we'll get to that, but I thought that was quite interesting. So I'm thinking that a lot of their budget would have gone to this this finale destruction scene, which we will get to. But
I think I was reading something like $25 million of the budget was used up in that that final sequence.
Yeah, which we'll obviously get to, but I still think to myself, ooh, after half the stuff I saw in that scene, it surely shouldn't have been that much.
I think maybe what they should have done is spent a bit more on Willem Dafoe's computer equipment. But I did have to laugh when he turned up. So Willem Dafoe turns up, like everybody else is dressed in all this, their finery and their best, getting on there. Willem Dafoe turns up. He has a kind of a mullet haircut and open shirt and is on the cruise by himself. So, you know, he must be the bad guy.
Yeah. And, of course, he uses the whole being a professional golfer as a bit of a front to everything that's been going on. I think that's what he says. He's a golfer or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. He smuggles all his equipment on in the golf equipment and then is pulling everything out of the golf clubs, but then, like, he's getting the wires out and everything like that, then suddenly he pulls out this massive box, which is labelled Fiber Optic Converter in massive letters on the top of it.
Oh, I love that.
Hang on. How did he pull that out of his golfing equipment?
I know, but it's almost like, you know, knowing in real world what that would be like, they wouldn't even have that written on there, but that's just so the audience knows, oh my god, that's what he's doing. Even if we don't know what that actually means, we know that's what he's using.
It's so technological, and look, he's got computer screens now, and dodgy 3D rendering of the ship that may have looked impressive in 97, but only just.
But that's the thing, and then you've got, like, Alex, or the James Patrick character, and Sandra Bullock as Annie. So you've got Alex and Annie on board the ship, and they happen to spot William Dafoe, because I think, Sandra Bullock happens to chat to him while she's getting a drink, and I love how his reasoning for, oh, he mustn't be a golfing guy, oh, because he hasn't looked at the screen once to look at the golfing match.
Yeah.
It's just this really weird, I don't know, the whole golfing thing just doesn't seem to work too well.
Yeah, and, oh, good on Alex. I mean, what a guy, you know, not only did he lie to Sandra Bullock about the extent of his police work. She thought he was a big cop, but he was actually a member of the SWAT team. And then, you know, he immediately notices Willem Dafoe and, you know, having a chat up with his girl, and then immediately notices the things that are off about him. And then they go dining, and he sees this this deaf girl who's looking absolutely bored, and he knows sign language. What a guy!
But then as soon as they, like you know, like, it's cool, they have these, you know, a lot of the, you know, I can, obviously it is a story that's playing out, and you're going to have all different plot things, but it's funny when you blatantly see that they're throwing something there that's going to be a plot device. I actually thought the blind girl would become more of a thing throughout the whole film, but as you'll find when we talk about this movie, it seems to go in stages. Like, it seems to resolve one sort of thing and then go on to the next sort of problem. It doesn't sort of, like, I thought she'd be a character that would be used a lot throughout the whole film, but they kind of sort of use it in the first half before they move on to the, I suppose, the destruction of the town, I suppose, which would be the next part. But yeah, I thought she'd be I thought the deaf girl would be a bigger part in the script. Yeah. But of course, oh, he can sit and do sign language with her. And as soon as that happened, I'm like, she's going to get lost and there's going to be some reason we'll need her. And I'm like, sure enough, she did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I thought she'd have a, she would have a bigger role given the amount of attention they were paying to her. Along with the photographer on the cruise, Dante, I thought he was going to have a bit of a bigger role because they really did focus on those characters quite extensively in the early movie.
And that's the thing about it. Like I was saying, it seems to sort of resolve one sort of subplot, I suppose, okay, and go into the next one. Because that was a big thing I noticed while I was watching it. I was like, oh god, it's kind of near the end and there's still 50 minutes of the movie to go, and then there's this whole extra section that happens. So it's like they've really designed, it's like three different people have written this movie and written three different parts to it, and they've just sort of linked them together. So yeah, I felt a lot of these characters that were introduced were just never really sort of developed, and they just sort of became these sub characters for the first half of the movie. So yeah, it was a really interesting way of making it. And it's interesting to know what obviously went on behind the scenes with the whole script writing. It did feel a lot like, yeah, they'd sort of written half. Oh, that's a movie. Oh no, it's only an hour long. We've got to write some more. So yeah, that was an interesting approach. But
we'll let the deaf girl get stuck in an elevator. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and it's like, and then, like, you know, just little things like, you know, of course, there's a scene where they walk on with this there's millions of dollars worth of jewelry on board and things like that, where you're just kind of like, oh, you're laying the seed for all these things that sort of don't really develop too much past what they could have been. So, but, the, you know...
Look, the jewelry, they're transporting millions of dollars worth of jewelry for, I'm assuming, some rich, you know, cruise customer, and the cruise director comes out and just says, who wants to look at millions of dollars worth of jewelry and try it on? Like, what?
But it's like she's, yeah, specific. I noticed when she said that line, it was like she was specifically going out of the way to pretty much even tell the audience too, hey guys, this is a bit of a plot, a plot key here. This is lots of millions of dollars worth of stuff that someone might want to steal eventually. Yeah, I just thought that was quite a ridiculous thing. But then you only had to see it play out even further, Trevor, to realise that that cruise director, she couldn't organise a fart at a curry eating contest.
The main thing I noticed about the cruise director is she was the one who played, I think it was Shelley, in Twin Peaks.
Okay.
She was Deputy Andy's girlfriend in Twin Peaks.
She reminded me a lot of Carol Kane. I actually thought it was her at first, but then, and I thought, as the thing went on, you think to yourself, gosh, you probably weren't the best cruise director to have, to have obtained. But, the big thing, like, the whole time watching it, I'm thinking to myself, Keanu Reeves, you probably did yourself a really world of good by not being involved in this. And, like, I'm a Sandra Bullock fan. Like, you know, I've always liked her, you know, and I was very happy when she finally won an Academy Award a couple of years ago and things like that. But this film, she just seems so off her game. Like, she was just sort of almost dealing with having to say half these lines. But I just also think they didn't really give much for her character to sort of do. It was all sort of very much about the Alex character in Geiger and the guys trying to stop the ship. So I really, her character almost seemed like you were watching as Speed was, the franchise was being stolen away from these, the last remaining lead that was still involved, you know, it was becoming a film of its own. So I don't really think she really would have didn't make too much difference to the film overall.
Yeah, I mean, I can take or leave Sandra Bullock depending on the movie. But yeah, I found that in this one, she was either frenetically excited or immensely whiny. And I found both sides just pretty unbearable. I did not enjoy any of her performance really in this. And yeah, the dialogue, especially the one-liners, I don't think I've ever seen a movie where so, which tries to throw in so many one-liners and so many little side gags where pretty much none of them hit.
That just reminds me offhand of that one of where she's chainsawing the door to release these people out that are stuck inside of this chamber area. And she keeps going with the chainsaw going a million miles an hour. And the guy's like, do you mind like putting the chainsaw down for a minute? What was that? Do you mind putting the chainsaw down for a minute? It was just these sort of attempts to try and, yeah, be funny, and it just wasn't working. But that was one of those scenes where I almost thought, you know, oh, they've got to give that another thing for Sandra Bullock to do because she doesn't have too much to do in this movie. But, yeah, that script was just, you know, I could see, as you said, about James Patrick wanting to, you know, wanting the script to be rewritten before you appeared on set. Because there's so many problems with it.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, I don't really think that, like, chainsaws would really be typical equipment on a cruise ship.
You wouldn't think they'd have them readily available, because that could even cause more problems than what we're thinking. But, yeah, it's that was quite a strange thing. But it all comes back to the whole thing, too, that I was thinking of, you know, like, we've established that first sort of 10 minutes of them, you know, a lot of scenes on road and things like that, and then they take us over to the boat. But the one thing that sort of struck me straight away was, is Annie as a character really somebody that we care about enough to really want to watch the continuing adventures of her? Because that essentially is what Speed 2 was or is. You know, it felt like we were just like, oh, okay, she's moved on from Keanu, next thing now, she's about to, you know, go on this, you know, romantic cruise with her partner. And, it just sort of felt like her as a character wasn't somebody that we really wanted to invest that sort of time in, which we were about to.
Yeah, well, really with either of them, I mean, as a couple, there was very little chemistry there, and I think it's clear that Jason Patrick was, he may have been phoning it in a little bit in a lot of those scenes. He certainly didn't seem to rise to a lot of what was given to him.
But then, like, looking at his performance first, say, something what he did in Lost Boys, like, it seems like he is very restrained, say, as an actor, or very much, he probably sits back and sort of watches it all unfold around him and goes, oh, my God. But, yeah, I think with this sort of case, he was probably looking for a hit or you know, a hit film and thought Speed 2 would be it.
Yeah, there was a stage, I mean, because you do have, even back then, I know a lot of people kind of, you know, hang a bit of rubbish on sequels, but by the stage, there had been a few movies which had quite successful sequels. So obviously anybody involved in Speed 2 would have been thinking that they would have been going into something that was going to be a pretty big thing, even if it only, you know, traded off the original in order to make its profit. Though I don't think they expected it to be as big as a bomb as it was.
And then, like, considering they were still able to get sort of, you know, one, I suppose, big name, of, if you can call it that, of the first, you know, from the first movie, I think they were, you know, they were happy with that. They, you know, if they hadn't have got Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves, I think they would have just not sort of bothered with it. But that was one thing that sort of struck me the entire time I was watching it. Would this have worked as a standalone movie? That's the thing. Like, if we could have said this, you know, could this have been a movie that stood alone as a movie about some guy taking over a cruise boat? So, I don't know. But then, as all these different problems we're saying now with the script are coming out, I'm seeing now that probably it wouldn't. So, I don't know. I think in different circumstances, the film, you know, could it have worked, but maybe not. I think it needed to be under that whole, yeah, the Speed banner, you know. But the biggest problem, and, you know, what you've probably read too in a lot of reviews and things, you know, the biggest thing is, how can you have a movie called Speed 2 where it's set on a cruise ship, which is probably one of the slowest vessels on water? So it's probably, it was probably doomed from the start, really.
Yeah, you do it by bookending it with Speed, you know. You start with a fast start on the roads with the cars and the trucks and the motorbikes and all that malarkey, and then, you know, you finish it with the cruise ship bearing down at top speed into, you know, heading straight towards an oil tanker. So there you go. So you got your speed at the start and the finish, whereas in the middle, it's just kind of, let's run around a ship and try to stop people from dying on a lifeboat malfunction.
And that's the biggest thing. Like, they were doing a lot of this stuff behind the scenes of, yeah, I mean, not behind the scenes, sorry, you know, of them trying to, you know, stop it all happening. But it really could have just done with sort of like 40 minutes being trimmed off the running time, because it just felt like I admittedly had to watch this film in stages, and it felt like you were just kind of, oh my God, is this ever going to end? Oh my God, oh, you think they've resolved it? Oh, then there's this, then there's this. So it just, and actually a big thing that I noticed, and, you know, Geiger wasn't probably shown enough in it, especially around the middle section. There was a lot of times too where we were kind of like, you know, what's happening, or we know what's happening, but we kind of wanted to see sort of the bad guy's perspective, but we didn't really get a lot of that too much. But then I suppose there wouldn't have been too much they could have shown a guy sitting at a computer going, what's happening, you know.
And when he did turn up, there was one particular moment, like when he confronts a captain, absolutely, like, reveals quite an expositional dialogue about why he's taking over the ship and what's going on, and there's lots of screaming and yelling, and he throws the captain overboard with a massive scream. Not a single person hears it, even though, like, 30 seconds after it happens, two women come walking along going, can you take our picture? Seriously, no one heard that. It was, like, probably the loudest thing happening on that part of the ship at the time.
Oh, no, it was very convenient for the filmmakers, let's just say that.
Yeah, as I said, there was a lot of, just logic leaps or just complete ignoring of logic, depending on which way you go, like the fact that when Alex saw, like, the captain's meditation balls, he just saw them and picked them up and just went, golf balls! That's how he's doing it. he's put bombs in golf balls. How did you think of that? You just suspected that the guy who said he was a golfer wasn't quite what he said. And then suddenly he's like, oh, that's how he's done it. He's got golf ball bombs.
And it's like they didn't really give much sort of thought into giving the to making I don't know, all the cruise boat customers seem to be quite these really deadpan sort of dumb quite people saying all these really simple things, you know, like, you know, I had to laugh when one of the customers as they're approached as the ship's about to crash, you know, it's got a bit of a way to go, but about to crash into the other liner or whatever it goes, do you think that boat will rescue us? Just lines like that, and you were like, oh gosh, just sort of felt like they just felt like they had to pad it out so much with all these supporting characters that you really just didn't care about, like, all the people that live on the boat. And honestly, there was a couple that I think fell into the water at one stage. I wish half of them had fallen into the water because we sort of got to know their characters and gone, yeah, you're kind of terrible people. Like, they were sort of setting it up, you know, with the deaf girl, like her parents were very much, you know, sort of ignoring her, or I think the father at one stage was telling her not to book, you know, bop along to the music and stuff like that. So you knew that she was sort of, you know, her parents were sort of a bit strict or a bit against her. So I was sort of wanting to see the parents have their sort of revenge. The girl to have a bit of a revenge at the end and stuff like that. But I think, they just really didn't develop those supporting characters too much. Just became too much about Alex trying to stop the ship.
Yeah, but back to the deaf girl, because there were a few things around her role that just got really strange. Like, she was wearing this little tutu and shirt at one point, and she gets stuck in the lift and she starts scaling the lift walls, and suddenly she's wearing bike pants under the tutu. And then when she's inevitably rescued by Alex and they're doing this sign language, she basically kind of says that, you know, if it doesn't work out with Sandra Bullock, she'll have him. And it's like, that's just kind of creepy because this girl is really young, and that's icky. Can we just move on? Yeah, okay, good. And once she's rescued and reunited with her parents, who were a pair of stuck up snobby no fun people, that was it. You know, didn't see her again, and for the rest of the movie, pretty much.
And it's like, yeah, a lot of these characters that were introduced so early on, by the time we get to the finale 2 hours into it, they're not sort of, it's all about, we've stopped the ship, but we sort of, any of these characters that they tried to make us care about, they just sort of, we'd forgotten about them about an hour ago. It's quite strange. It was like I said, it was like it was a movie written in two parts or three parts by separate people and just shoved together.
Yeah, I think it really was a movie that was just like, okay, we're at this point. What can we do now? Oh, well, make the deaf girl trapped. Okay, cool, she's trapped. What do we do now? And they kind of forget about that for a while. And then it's like, oh, everyone's trying to escape in this lifeboat that's about to have its cable snap and fall into the water. And, okay, oh, that's right, the deaf girl's parents. We haven't talked about them for a while. They must be wondering where their daughter is. And then suddenly it becomes relevant briefly. And then again forgotten about for quite some time. Until inevitably they remember, hang on, that's right, the deaf girl's still trapped. We better get the hero to save her.
Yeah.
It was just like, but nothing was really made to connect these things in a seamless or logical manner. It just jumps all over the place.
Oh, yeah. It just seems to prove that the screenwriters had no idea really what angle they wanted to go with this movie. So I think, you know, and the end result shows.
Oh, dearie, dearie me.
There's all these, I've just got a few notes here about sort of different dialogue and stuff like that. Like, you know, like at the very end, one of the cast members goes, one of the characters goes, God, I hope someone got that on tape. Ha, 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 yeah, because we're watching a movie, and unfortunately we did get that on tape. And then the section where, when things are getting quite intense and, I was going to say, Annie or Sandra Bullock, someone says something to her and she goes, don't worry, I've been in worse situations than these, trust me. Ah, oh, ha, ha, see, a reference to the first movie.
When she goes back for a driving test for the second time with the same driving instructor and she's about to pull out and a bus goes past, she goes, oh, that bus was going pretty fast. That's a bit dangerous.
I couldn't even, Like, I thought it was excruciating enough that she had all those driving test things at the start of Speed 2, but the fact that they had to bring it in as sort of a bookend for the film was like, oh, God, don't go back there again. Please do not reiterate the fact that she can't drive.
And then, I mean, even before that, when I suppose you get to the finale, they're heading down towards the cruise, they're set on a collision course for an oil tanker that won't have enough time to get out of the way, but then it just keeps going and going and going. And then suddenly they remember that there's some manual valves that will actually let them change the course of the ship. Why didn't they use that when they realized they were off course a third of the way into the movie? You know, they were there the entire time, and no one thought of using these manual overrides to make sure that the ship stayed on the correct course.
Oh, God, I wish they had. Maybe the movie would have been half an hour shorter, like we all wanted. Actually, no, even shorter than that would have been good.
I think this movie could have just been Speed 2. No, the end.
Exactly, yeah. And it all comes back to what I said. Like, I don't even think, going ahead of myself a bit, I don't even know if it would have worked even as a standalone movie. You know, it was just too meh. Yeah. Not enough. Even though a lot was happening, but it wasn't a lot happening in substance. It was just very much like what you said. They get to a certain point and go, oh, what can we do next? We'll throw in every bit of the kitchen sink we can think of, you know, and it doesn't sort of round itself out and work quite well. But admittedly, I do... You know, sort of, as I said, it's taken me a few viewings to get through it. But sort of the one that sort of got me kind of excited again was the destruction in the second scene, or the when they hit pretty much land, because that kind of got my interest going again. And it was sort of too much too late, I think. So, but I believe that would have been what they were referring to as the most expensive destruction scene ever filmed in a movie. It may have been beaten since.
yeah. So, I mean. Just, I suppose, to go through that. So the ship is on a collision course with an oil tanker. They suddenly remember these valves, which mean that they can alter the course of the ship. So instead of colliding with this oil tanker, making a massive explosion, its duel is a situation where it scrapes along the side, and the oil tanker's anchor rips a hole in the ship right in front of Jason Patrick. Surprisingly, and then they plow through all these pleasure boats and ships and into this town. And this entire town, when you're watching this ship crash into it, it's like, is this entire town built on water? Because it just keeps going and going, and it cut back to the navigator who's reading out the... Every time the speed drops one knot, you've got him saying what the speed is, just continuously all the way through until it finally does come to a stop, and he just goes, 0 knots! And that's not funny anymore. And then it cuts back, and the ship's basically just the ship length into this dock area to do combos. It went way further than that! I mean, there's no way that it crashed for that long, and that's as far as it's gotten into this town, which is apparently entirely built on jetties above water.
Like, you're watching is like building upon building, and I don't mean just like, you know, buildings next to each other, buildings that are sort of rows upon rows of buildings being destructed. Yeah, and the first thing I thought was, surely it would have got further than that, the amount of destruction that we saw. And the part that I loved was, okay, admittedly it is a movie and we know they're using sets, but you could tell that everything they were destroying was an actual set, because I think at one stage they crashed through a diving shop or something like that. But you could plainly see that the shop had absolutely no products whatsoever. It was pretty much just this empty building.
made of plywood that could be easily crashed through.
And I do love the bit where it's like this little kid the whole time. Pretty much as the boat's coming, pretty much the whole time, you've got this little kid going with mum, there's a boat. And she's like, oh, that's nice, dear. Aren't they, isn't he cute? And then pretty much the boat's coming pretty much to where it's going to, like, you know, pretty much destroy them. And then she's like, oh, I believe them now. And I thought that was kind of cute. But, yeah, admittedly, I was thinking, like, because this went over for 5 minutes, this sort of... kept going throughout this whole town. And yeah, as you said, it was probably only the length of not even of the ship itself that it destroyed. But I thought that was quite funny. But yeah, it did literally. It actually made me sort of yell out at the screen, "Hurry up! Watch out! It's going to end soon, surely!" Because it did keep going for ages. Yeah. So.
And then they had to introduce a little dog barking at the ship during the entire thing, and then there was a guy going, "Oh no, my car!"
And it stops, but then
the ship stops and its anchor breaks off and crashes the car.
And we think that the dog who was sitting in the exact same spot has been squashed, but no, 5 seconds later, the dog jumps out, not even realizing what had happened.
so wacky. And then, like, we've got this massive gratuitous destruction scene, and that's not even the end of the movie. I mean, it seemed quite climactic. But no, because of course Sandra Bullock has been kidnapped by the bad guy, and there's a big chase scene across the water, with then turns into him suddenly finding a seaplane that he can just get into and fly. So we've got exciting chase and climb onto a seaplane scene, and it then he crashes into the tower on the oil tanker, and the oil tanker explodes anyway, which was they were trying to avoid in the first place, and a great portion of the Caribbean ecosystem would have been destroyed. Happy ending!
I actually think the film industry would have been destroyed when this movie was released, but anyway. Oh, gosh. But, yeah, it just seemed like so many times you thought it was the end and it just kept going into the next sort of next plot development. But, and I think really that was, you know, a matter of, you know, like you really should have just picked one sort of set thing to concentrate on. But, yeah, it all comes back to, I think I'd stick with the bus, thank you.
I think it's a case of they had so many people going, this would be cool, this would be cool, oh, this is cool, and then they just try to cram as much of the different climax scenes as they could into that very long, very drawn out, very gratuitous, action set piece upon set piece towards the end. And frankly, I was getting bored with it by the time it got through.
Let's just say, I think about an hour, like it goes to 2 hours and five, about an hour and about an hour 20. Like, this is at different stages. I was going, oh, okay, is this almost finished? And then knowing I had over 40 minutes left to watch of the film, and that was, you know, when that happens, you're not being entertained by a film. it's hard.
Indeed. Even once it's all done, you've got your last joke and the little nod towards the original movie with the fast bus, and you were mentioning before about the music over the closing credits, and there was a bit of UB40 in there, but it was like it's almost like a medley, and there were these Caribbean cover versions of songs, and I just went, this is all just terrible.
Maybe they assumed no one would have stuck around in the cinema for as long as then to hear it. I don't know.
Well, they should have been thinking about us who forced ourselves to watch the very end.
I know, God, I think we're some of the few people that have actually watched this movie in its entirety and been forced to do so. So, yeah, it's not an experience I want to run back to anytime soon.
You won't be speeding back?
No. Even though if they decide to make a Speed 3 and decide to set it on a bus, I honestly think it would still be better than Speed 2.
Fair enough. Well, I guess we're probably moving into those final thoughts, and if there were any redeeming features within. Now, you picked the movie, so I think I will go first this time, if that's all right with you.
No worries.
And, you know what? Back in the 90s, I didn't mind UB40 all that much, so it was kind of cool to see them there. Okay, that's it for the redeeming stuff. It was terrible from start to finish. The dialogue was terrible, the one-liners were forced, and none of them were funny. I actually felt no chemistry between the leads, and I've got no idea what Willem Dafoe was going for, since he kind of veered between these different acting styles wildly throughout the movie. Sandra Bullock was just plain annoying, in quite so many ways. Even in the boat chase scene where Jason Patrick, commandeers the boat with the two, Caribbeans on there, Susie compared the girl on the boat to Jar Jar Binks, the way she was talking. And that finale sequence was way too long and was so continuously gratuitous, that I just was rapidly losing the ability to care. I actually think that this movie could have been well improved if the shark from Jaws the Revenge turned up and basically ate most of the cast. Because Jaws the Revenge was actually quite a good movie. That was a nice surprise. So you can probably guess, Christian, that I consider this movie not redeemable at all.
Well, you know what, Trevor, I'd like to say that, I'd love to say that I'm being the person that picked this movie that, you know, there's more that you have to see about this movie that, you know, you're not seeing it. But honestly, Trevor, I think I agree with a lot of the stuff that you said. Like, I found this film to be, I've actually got it here in big letters, I found this film to be absolutely boring. And I think the biggest problem was it was too long, it was trying so hard to be, pretty much, it was the opposite of what its title was. When you're going to see something called Speed 2, this is not the sort of film you'd be envisaging or expecting. So I felt that it was, you know, much too slow. And, you know, it, to me, there's no sort of fast-paced action involved when you're pretty much essentially waiting for a slow-moving cruise ship to hit another vessel, which is pretty much what the entire plot of this film was based around. Whilst you've got, you know, you've got the plan, you know, you've got the attempt to thwart the sort of problem by the lead characters, but it just wasn't enough to sort of sustain a movie. And as you said, you know, you've got this performance by Willem Dafoe, who didn't really know if he was trying to be a pantomime character or play it dead serious. So, you know, when you've got a bad script and possibly not the best lead performances, there's really not much else you can lean on for a movie. So, and I think, you know, there just wasn't enough in, as I said, you know, you've got this whole, you know, ship going to hit another ship. You know, aside from that, and you've got Alex trying to stop this happening, I just don't think that story, and plus Annie and Alex's story, was really enough to sustain a movie or really get us interested. I do admit, though, Trevor, the third reel or the final destruction scene kind of piqued my interest a little bit in the film and kind of got me interested in it again. But I do think it was very gratuitous and it's, you know, it was probably very much uncalled for. And hey, the budget of the film was blown out of proportion because of it. But hey, if you trimmed off, say, 40 minutes of the movie and used that finale scene, well, pretty much trim 40 minutes of the middle of the film off, I think we'd have a much better movie. But it all comes back to the thing. Big thing I want to question is, do you think this would have worked as a standalone film? I'm not too sure, but I do think this was too slow, too boring, and it's not really something that I'd want to go back and see again. So please, I'd rather our listeners watch Speed 1 twice than have to be put through this double feature. So, yeah, so that's what my thoughts are. So I'm very much the same as you, Trevor, but, you know, where we do contrast, I do think that final sort of destruction scene put it onto a new level for me, gave it an extra star. So that was because I crave things like that in films. So, but, you know, I still don't think this is a good movie, and I don't ever aim to watch it ever again.
Fair enough. So that's a big double not redeemable. Now, I do have one other person who just wanted to add her opinion. And so I'm just going to bring Susie, you've heard her before on the podcast, going to bring her to the microphone. She wanted to have her own opinion on this because she actually watched it with me the other night.
Oh, she was game.
and this is what she thinks.
Hi. Hi, Susie's opinion is this movie is utter, utter, utter shite. It should never be shown again anywhere for the love of humanity. Thank you, I'm out.
Thank you, Susie. I think that makes this a very much a unanimous, not redeemable.
For sure, and I don't wish to ever go through Speed 2 Cruise Control ever again. But yeah, is there anyone out there, Trevor, who likes this movie?
Oh, funny you should ask that. I've actually found another review from that wonderful site Amazon, which is full of reviews and makes it very easy to do this sort of stuff at the end of a podcast. And this review is titled Action Classic. I actually truly must stick up for this movie as I love it. It's just an old school classic action movie. Hell yeah, it's cheesy in places, but that just adds to the charm. It's big, bold, and lots of fun on a massive scale. Way more than the original. Am I the only one that thinks the original is boring? Speed, the original had Keanu, who is just a donkey turd at acting in anything. Dennis Hopper was also boring. I think Willem Dafoe was a great villain. Much better. An over-the-top eccentric performance and a good story arc. Of course, Sandra Bullock is back, who I love. Crazy over-the-top again, but she's a fine actress and good to look at. This sequel had bigger action. It was more plausible as they were on the water and not in traffic. Great budget, explosions, etc. Jason Patrick is a decent lead. Better than Keanu any day. This is top popcorn fun and classic action from start to finish. Underrated, I say. Go back to it and you will probably enjoy it. 5 stars.
Were they watching the same movie that we just watched? It does make you wonder.
Well, they're pretty specific, so unfortunately, yeah, I think we can pretty much say that they were.
We'll have to agree to disagree with that reviewer, but interesting to know there's some diehards out there, but hey, there's one in every crowd.
Absolutely. It certainly doesn't want to make me reconsider my opinion either. I am never watching Speed 2 ever again.
Cool. I'm glad that I was the one to make you watch it, but I'm sorry that I made you watch it. So I'll be interested to see, Trevor, though, what catastrophes that you are going to unleash on us for the next one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got to admit, there's quite a few I do want to visit, but I almost think that there's one that we have to do. Absolutely cannot avoid this movie, so I figured that to show my confidence in this one as to if we could redeem it, I just want to get it out of the way as soon as possible. It's kind of a movie series that's kind of evolved along with the redeeming features. The first one was done way, way back at the start of the podcast when I just did like a little list of potential redeeming features by myself. Number two was when we had a more full-on redeeming feature section within the one podcast we did every fortnight. So I think it's only right that the third in this movie series we should cover in our brand new format. Well, I say brand new, it's the second season of us doing this. You may get an inkling of where I'm going with this, and I'm not going to beat around the bush any longer. Christian, we are going to head to 2011 and check out Blood Rain, the Third Reich.
Oh, gosh, Trev, you and your Blood Rain. Gosh, I can see you just itching to get these out of your system too. So, look, I'm up for the challenge because the last one was quite an interesting movie-watching experience. So I'm up for the challenge. So Blood Rain 3 from 2011.
Can vampire Nazis beat vampire cowboys? That's the question.
I might be able to tell you in a couple of weeks' time. I'm up for the challenge. And, I think this is good. And honestly, after what we've just watched with Speed 2 Cruise Control, I'm after something totally different. So I think this will be the perfect choice. So I'm up for the challenge, Trevor.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm not sure if I am, but you know what? I will give it my all. Can this be the movie that redeems the entire series? That's the big question.
You never know. Or you could just do what I do and suggest a film and spend the whole time watching it going, oh God, why did I suggest this?
That's a distinct possibility.
It can only go up from here. That's the positive to take from this. So.
Yeah, well, as we know from review experience, it's all too easy to keep going down.
I know, and we've proven, we've managed to dig out some of the worst films ever made, and even if people hadn't even thought they existed, we'll find them. So, yeah, and Blood Rain 3, well, that's something I would never go out of my way to watch normally, so I'm prepared to give it a go.
Fantastic. Now, if anybody out there has anything they would like to say about Blood Rain 3, we'll be happy to incorporate that into our next Redeeming Features cast. Or even if you have comments on Speed 2 Cruise Control, do you think we were too harsh? Do you think it was so bad that even with our massively negative opinions, we were still too generous. We would love to hear from you. It's super duper easy to get in touch with us. You can head to rufusproject.com and leave a comment under this very episode. You can send us an email to therufusproject@gmail.com, or you can easily find us on Twitter or Facebook. Christian also has many events that he organizes. If you listen to the mini podcast, you'll hear some of the stuff that he gets up to, but you can certainly head to christianfletcher.com or find Christian Fletcher Events on Facebook in order to see some of the cool stuff coming up, which sometimes even involves us. Hey, Christian.
Sometimes, if we're lucky. So yeah, keep a lookout, guys, and we'll keep you posted about a few projects we've got coming in the next couple of months. So looking forward to it.
Excellent and fantastic. So I think we should wrap this up, Christian. As always, it may not be a pleasure watching these movies, but it's always such a pleasure to do this podcast about them. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Trevor, and thanks for subjecting yourself to the movies that I suggest as well. So I look forward to, I don't know if I look forward to it, but I'm going to attempt Blood Rain 3, so I look forward to speaking to you about that.
Awesome. Maybe not. All right, bye.
See ya.
Too good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad, I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm the B, says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.
Everything I do is purely 'cause I'm able to get hold of you.